What's going to separate humans from the robots? And what are those skills and mindsets that no matter how fast or advanced technology gets, you always need humans in the workplace for?
Welcome to The Lavender Lifestyle, the podcast on personal growth and lifestyle design. My name's Eileen, and I'm here to guide you to shine as your brightest self and create your dream life. We all have a light within and the power to create a life we love. Every Sunday, we'll share thoughtful conversations exploring how we can build a better future for ourselves and our world. Life is an art. Make it your masterpiece. Hello, my loves. Welcome back to the Lavender Lifestyle Podcast. It's Eileen. Today's episode is such a good one with a great story and refreshing practical takeaways. We're talking personal growth and emotional intelligence, covering the deep human skills that set us apart from AI and robots, like social and emotional skills, and how to cultivate them in order to thrive and succeed in life. Our guest today is Crystal Lim Langa. Crystal Lim Langa is best known as Singapore's work bestie, a 2x LinkedIn top voice. She is a thought leader in leadership and personal growth, the co-author of the best-selling book, Deep Human, and has taught more than 100,000 people deep human emotional intelligence skills. As a CEO of leadership consultancy, Forrest Wolf, she has trained senior leaders at many of the best companies and government institutions in the world. She's also a highly sought-after mentor, and her Deep Human Club, a mentoring program for 150 professional leaders, has a six-month waitlist. Season one of her podcast, Comfort and Growth, debuted at number one in Singapore on Spotify podcast charts, and you can find her on IG, TikTok, and LinkedIn, where she actively shares informal and practical advice on productivity, work, and personal growth. Before we begin, a quick plug for my favorite New Year planning tool. The Artist of Life Workbook is your ultimate guide to design an intentional and successful 2025. With 150 pages of prompts and exercises, it helps you reflect, set meaningful goals, and stay accountable to creating a life you love. If you want to create your best year, go to shop.lavender.com to get your copy now. All right, onto the interview. Hello, Crystal. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, Eileen. I'm great. It's a bright and early morning. I can't wait to get into our conversation.
Yeah, for reference, it's 7 a.m. for Crystal. It's like 4 p.m. for me because Crystal's in Singapore. I'm in LA. But yeah, thank you so much for making the time. I know you're a busy lady.
It's such a pleasure. And I've been meaning to do this since we met in Singapore.
Yeah. I love how I just got to meet you and Rachel. Like, I met so many inspirational people when I was in Singapore. It's like also such a great community. Like, you all know each other, and there's so many girl bosses.
Okay, and I don't want to get like too into the social economics of it, but like in Singapore, a lot of women work. We have like dual income families because property prices are so high. But the other thing is that we also are very, very blessed in Singapore to be able to have live-in help, domestic help with us.
All right.
So it means it's actually, I must say, whenever I talk about being like a female boss or working mother and all of that, I must acknowledge that in Singapore, we have certain advantages that are not very common in the rest of the world. So that means that there's always somebody, you know, cooking for me, looking after my house, like doing all this stuff so that I have a wife, in other words, and I can go off and like do everything that I want to do. Yeah. Amazing. So we're very lucky.
Thank you for saying that. I knew it, but I didn't realize how big of an impact that makes. It's true. It allows you to pursue a career and have a family.
Yeah. And it's also like, you know, the mental load that you hear so much of in the Western countries. I think in Asia, it's slightly different because either we have like a more communal kind of living arrangement where it's like multi-generations in the same house. It's kind of like it takes a village. Yeah. Either that or you tend to have live-in help if you're lucky enough to, which is most people, you know, in the working world are. So in the corporate world, I mean.
And it's nice to see how far you can go because you have this culture. Like it's different.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, amazing. So Crystal, why don't you start by telling us your story for listeners who don't know your story? How did you go from working in corporate to becoming this thought leader in leadership and personal growth?
I kind of say that my career, I've been an accidental many, many things. I've been an accidental banker, accidental educator, accidental influencer now on all of that. Yeah. But I never really planned everything the way that I thought it would work out. So when I was, start of my career, I studied law school and I did that in England. Mm-hmm. And I got recruited accidentally in my second year of law school because if you know anything about England, you know the food in college is very, very bad. Especially when I went to school, this is like 20 plus years ago. So I actually snuck into a meeting room where I saw there were sausage rolls and, you know, refreshments and hors d'oeuvres and things. And I was like stuffing my face with all this free food. It was actually a recruitment event for an investment bank.
Oh, that's hilarious.
You know, so there I was in kind of like my ready bathrobe, stuffing my pockets with sausage rolls. And then suddenly the lights went on in the room. And there was this banker in his suit. And he said, like, young lady, what are you doing here? And I freaked out. But I think something in me has always been a little bit of like the kind of showman. So mm-hmm. I like under stress, I just kind of perform. So I made up some story on the spot and said, like, you know, I'm here and I'm sampling the food because I'm on the students committee and we're doing a survey of different recruitment events, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
and he kind
God,
of looked
hilarious.
At me and he kind of knew that... And he said to me, you know what? I don't believe a word of what you said, but you're really good at telling stories. So maybe you should join investment banking.
That is so random. Also, that's like a career that's really tough to get into.
It is. It's so random. And you know, the thing is that as a law student, I had absolutely no idea what an investment bank was or what banking
wow.
was. But he gave me his card and he said, you know, we have an office, UBS, Warburg, Dillon, Reed, in those days it was known. We have a big office in Liverpool Street. And he said, because, you know, I was studying in Northern England. So for perspective, that's like 3 hours from London. And he said, if you come down for an interview, we will reimburse you for like your whatever, your travel costs and this and that. So I'm like, oh, great, free trip to London. Why not? And that's how I became a banker because I went down to London. I thought it was a jolly. It was totally like, you know, there was no stress at all because I didn't really want the job. I didn't know what the job was about. And it was only after the interview that I learned that there were like thousands and thousands of people from Oxford and Cambridge and like, I don't know, all the prestigious universities going for this same job. And they're only going to pick like 80 of us from all around the world.
Yeah. It's competitive.
I know. I had no clue. So I was lucky.
It was a job or was it an internship?
It was a summer internship, but there were literally tens of thousands of the smartest brains that were up for this. And then there was me who didn't know anything about it and just rocked up there. And everyone else had their, you know, HP 27C calculators and I didn't have anything.
I love that though. And you got in.
I did. And I think part of it is that investment banking, you know, like most client-facing, people-facing roles, at the end of the day, it's about connection. They want to know, do you have the confidence? Are you quick on your feet? If I put you in front of a client, you know, are you in front of a CEO, you know, are you going to be able to make conversation and look presentable and not disgrace us in front of the client? Or are you going to be, you know, professional, presentable, smart, and all of that? So I think a lot of it, you know, can be learned on the job. But anyway, coming back to the point, that was the first time in my life where I realized that, oh, wow, it's not about the hard skills. Yeah, because at that point of time, I didn't know anything about accounting, DCF models, analysis, finance, nothing. But like what got me into the door was like I had this, I had social emotional skills, which is what I do right now in my career. I teach people about the kind of insider secrets, if you will, the hacks, the cheat codes, you know, of the corporate world that nobody teaches you in school. You know, things like how do you have a difficult conversation? How do you connect with a, you know, somebody? How do you persuade? How do you influence? How do you motivate? And I think all the way to those early days where I was you know, learning on the job as an investment banker, I knew that I wasn't going to be the best analyst. I wasn't going to be like the most financially savvy. But what I could do was really establish a connection and create trust really easily with people. So that was the first decade of my life was investment banking, institutional sales and trading, working on the sales and trading floor in equity sales. And then after that, I did a complete pivot. I got really burned out when I was 29. I had two kids in quick succession. And also, unfortunately, I went through a marital crisis with my ex-husband. And it was like a really tumultuous period in my life. So at 29, I kind of figured out that I wanted to leave the financial world and take a break. And me and my ex-husband, we bought a farm. Like, we bought a vineyard in Australia.
Wow.
And yeah, I went from being this like big city banker, you know, to living on a vineyard with my two little kids and, you know, learning how to grow grapes, make Pinot Noir.
Let's take a moment to thank today's sponsor, Oak Essentials. As we step into the new year, it's the perfect time to show your skin some extra love. Oak Essentials brings you clean, luxurious skincare that turns your daily routine into a soothing self-care ritual. Their products are cruelty-free, non-GMO, and free from silicones, sulfates, and colorants, so you can feel good about what you're using. If you're looking for the perfect gift or a complete skincare experience, the routine is your answer. This set includes the cleansing balm, balancing mist, ritual oil, moisture-rich balm, and restorative mask, all beautifully packaged and ready to gift. Each product nourishes, hydrates, and rejuvenates, giving you a glow that lasts. This holiday season, treat yourself and your loved ones to spa quality skincare essentials that deliver a moisture rich glow. My followers will get a 15% off their first order when you use the code TLL15 at checkout. That's 15% off your first order at OAKESSENTIALS.com, promo code TLL15. Get your best radiant skin this season with Oak Essentials.
Was that your decision? Whose decision, and how did you get to that?
Okay, it's kind of, if double click on it, it's kind of a longer story, but
okay.
I found out that my husband was having an affair right after, like, or rather he was, you know, not faithful. And this was like right after I gave birth to my second kid. So obviously I went into this huge marital crisis.
Right.
And it was really difficult because I was coping with like this destruction of everything that I had known internally. I don't want to sound dramatic because this is
no,
like...
No, but it is very dramatic, right? It's like everything came crumbling down moment.
Yeah. And it started me kind of questioning like how much of my previous life was real. Like how many years had this been going on, or like, you know, how much of it was real that I indeed had this beautiful family and this, you know, whatever, great marriage and all of that. So it just sent me into this period of soul searching that I think I was 29 years old. And I think that's one of those big moments. You're about to turn 30. I had two kids. And then suddenly I'm like in this like identity crisis. And then to be honest, I think like I didn't want to end the marriage abruptly because I was also scared. I was like, oh shit, you know, I've got two little kids and I don't know like what it's going to be like being a single mom. So I thought, okay, let's give this a shot. Not purely altruistically because like, you know, it's the best thing.
No, I understand. It's like you felt like you needed help too. You're confused.
Yeah, I was really confused and I didn't know what to do. But I thought, okay, the prudent thing to do is at least give this a go. So I spoke to a few of my banker friends who had been in the same situation. Believe it or not, in Asian culture, banking culture, this kind of situation is very, very normal. Yeah. So the husbands travel a lot and like there's a lot of these kind of incidences. So I was like talking to my friends and like, what did you do? And a lot of them recommended this thing called the Hoffman process.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever heard of it. Are you in LA?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's quite popular mm-hmm. with people in LA as well. I think Gwyneth Paltrow was talking about it in Goop and blah, blah, blah. And like all these people, I think Justin Bieber famously ran out of the retreat. But many, many famous people have gone through it. It's essentially like a 7-day hardcore group therapy kind of program where you learn about your self-sabotaging behavioral patterns. You do this therapy with other people. You kind of break these limiting beliefs, da, 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 da. So it's kind of like surgery, if you will, for
your emotions.
Yeah, for your emotions. It's like processing stuff. It's like healing. So I went for this Hoffman process with my ex-husband, which is highly not recommended. You're not supposed to do it with your partner. But it was interesting because I went in there, Lynn, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. My attitude was like, this guy, he's stuffed up. And he needs to go for this retreat. And I'm perfect. I'm fine. I may have this mild problem with perfectionism, but but I'm cool, you know? So I was horrified because over the 7 days, I just realized that I was full of beep, you know? I was like, you know, living my life in a way that was not aligned with my values. I had no idea what mindfulness was. I didn't know how to be present with myself. I just wasn't, you know, living in a way that I considered intentional or authentic. And I think it took that 7-day personal growth therapy-based retreat to really wake me up and realize that there was a different way of being. And it wasn't all about success and doing. And I remember one of my big discoveries was my therapist said to me, you're human doing. You're not a human being because you have absolutely no idea how to be. You're just so busy doing, doing, doing. And if you don't do, you don't know who you are. And that was like when the penny dropped and I was like, oh, that was the retreat that changed my life. Because after I came out of that retreat, I was like, okay, I don't want to be in Singapore anymore. I want to go to Australia. I want to take a break. I want to get in touch with my other neglected parts of myself. I've over kind of like stimulated my brain. But how about my heart, my emotions, my body, my spirit? These are all aspects of myself that I neglected for so long. And I wanted to get away from the noise and discover who I was. And then that was what prompted this kind of move. And on another more selfish level, I mean, because Singapore, as you alluded to, is so small. And then when like everyone discovered like my marriage was in trouble, it's also one of those things where I was kind of like in magazines and like, you know, like whatever, quite, I don't know, out and about in town. And I was just like, you know what?
Also, there's like gossip, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of gossip and like, oh my God, did you hear what happened? Da, da, da. It's so sad and all of that. And I was just like, you know what? I just want to take a break from this environment for a while and try to like heal my marriage if it can be healed somewhere far away from all of this. So it was a little bit of both carrot and stick, like push and pull. Yeah. And then we did this thing where we fell in love with this vineyard. And it was just so gorgeous. We moved to this place called Mornington Peninsula, which is south of Melbourne. And it's got beaches. It's kind of like the Hamptons, I guess, or Napa Valley with beaches. It's like a vineyard sort of filled area. And it was beautiful. But I spent 6 years as a stay-at-home mom.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good amount of time.
Yeah.
Complete shift.
Yeah, it really was a good amount of time. And I also became like a mompreneur. I don't know if that's a...
Right.
Yeah, I became an entrepreneur at the same time. And that was when I started a business doing luxury, high-end personal growth retreats. And it was like way ahead of its time. So yeah, because this is like in 2011 and wellness wasn't a mega trend. Like nobody even did yoga in 2011, 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It was still early.
Yeah, it was very fringe. People weren't doing yoga and drinking green juice and doing mindfulness. All of that happened only in the last, I don't know, 7-8 years. Mm-hmm. So when I started this business, my idea was I'm going to run these retreats in Bhutan, in like the mountains, in like different tranquil areas of the world, in Bali, in the mountains and all of that. And I hired all these like psychotherapists, mindfulness teachers, etc. And it was supposed to be like a week away where you reset and you reboot, just like how you send your car in for servicing once a year, like, you know, taking time out to get really clear about what your values and what you want and how you're living your life, blah, blah, blah. So I did that in 2011. And because it was so ahead of the market, it wasn't really successful. So I made a loss, a six-digit loss on that like company, but it taught me a lot of things.
Oh, wow.
So then the next phase of my career was actually when I got headhunted by the National University of Singapore. And I was living in Australia then, but one of the people in my retreats actually was related to someone who was on the board of directors for the National University of Singapore.
I love that. So you got something out of doing the retreats. You met the right people. Because when you're doing a luxury retreat, it's like these are top tier people that can, they have amazing connections, right?
Absolutely. So we were meditating in the mountains in Bhutan. And this guy who was one of my participants, he's like a really senior CEO of one of the biggest headhunting firms in the world. So he was a global chairman and CEO. And he looked at me and he said, like, you're doing this with people who are so old. We're all in our 50s, 60s, 70s. And this is really good stuff. But we're all cooked, you know, like it's like, you know, we've been in the oven, the timer went off, ding, it's like we're cooked, you know. Uh-huh. But he's like, why don't you bring this kind of work to people who are at the beginning of their journeys, like younger university students, etc. Because I was teaching things like mindfulness, like how to focus, like I was teaching self-mastery.
And all these things you learned in your like 6 years of quiet living in Australia?
Yes, and also through doing a lot of therapy retreats. I was just fascinated by the field of personal growth. Went off and I did so many things, whether it was Enneagram, whether it was like, yeah, you know, understanding family constellations, all these like different ways of different parts of aspects of personal growth. So when I came back and I put them all together, I got the best teachers that I knew to come together and run a process that was really about living in accordance to your values and living powerfully, both internally and externally. Because I knew a lot of people who were very outwardly successful, but internally they felt like a failure. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, how do we make your insides match your outsides as well? So that person, his name was Damien O'Brien. He was a global chairman of Egon Zehnder, which is one of like the most reputed headhunting companies in the world, or, you know, I should say executive search. So he then introduced me to his Singapore head, and she knew that NUS, the National University of Singapore, was looking for a change agent, for somebody who could come in and really prepare the youth of Singapore for the future of work. And this, wow, is like a mouthful, because like back then, this is 2015. If you know anything about Singapore government, it's super futuristic. So they have, you know, we are always thinking 10, 20, 100 years into the future. We're making all these plans so like we can, you know, win in the long term.
Yeah, it's inspiring.
Yeah. So back in 2015, this is like nearly 10 years ago, way before AI was so trendy, but Singapore government was like starting this initiative called Skills Future, where it was all about how do we skill up a nation so that we are ready for AI when it comes in 8 years' time.
Yeah. Incredible. So ahead of its time.
Yeah. So in 2015, they were trying to start in all these national programs about like skilling up people. So for instance, everyone had like, I guess the equivalent of $800 that was deposited into a special Skills Future bank account. And the government said this like $800 is a credit for you to use in any kind of course that can give you new skills. So it could be anything from like cake baking or decorating. It could be financial analysis. It could be, you know, AI course. But the government just wanted the whole nation to really start having that growth and learning mindset. And so when I was hired, it was during that wave where, you know, I was hired essentially to set up an institute called the Center for Future Ready Graduates. So the big trending word was like future proof, future ready, you know, everything was like, you know, getting ready for the future. And so when I was hired, they asked me to go off and speak to hundreds and hundreds of employers, like, you know, your Googles, your GEs, and, you know, JP Morgans and Citibanks, you know, all these people who are hiring our students, and try to find out from the employers, like, what did they think were future-ready skills? Like when they were hiring, what were the skills of the future they were looking for? So me and my team, we went off and we did all of this research. We talked to 300 employers. And what we found out from them was that they weren't so much looking for the hard skills. Yeah, they, you know, because like in the world of the future, everything technical that can be coded will eventually be done by robots and automated. Yeah. So it's almost like we can almost teach, use AI to code already, right? So what are going to be the skills of the future? The skills that will separate us from the robots was the question. What's going to separate humans from the robots? And what are those skills and mindsets that no matter how fast or advanced technology gets, you always need humans in the workplace for? Yeah, what are those things that can be coded?
What were the main ones? And then you were in charge of like teaching these skills?
Yes, absolutely. So I mean, generally, in a nutshell, you want to be looking at careers or jobs or skills that involve creativity, that involve a high level of strategy, and also a high level of caring and emotional intelligence. Because these three are the hardest skills for the machines to replicate. They're already starting to catch up in terms of creativity, in terms of strategy. However, what's going to be really distinguishing us from the robots is that ability to have higher level emotional intelligence. Because, for example, empathy is the ability to say to another human, wow, I get that. It's like, I see the world from your perspective. Like, I really get what you're going through, Lynn. Like, that sounds really frustrating. I can relate to that. It's different when it comes from a human. Like, if an AI says that, you're like, okay, but you're not human.
You know? Yeah, you're lying.
Exactly. So that's why what I've learned, you know, in this final phase of my career, which is after I left the university, I started my own leadership company. What I've learned is that like everyone needs these skills in the workplace. And today I work with some of the best companies in the world, you know, whether it's like Airbus or GSK or Pfizer, or, you know, all these companies running their leadership training programs, helping their new leaders acquire these skills of how to deal with people, or helping their senior leaders understand what's going on in their culture. And really, it's almost like being, the other day, one of my clients said, you're like a therapist and a shaman.
Oh,
in the corporate world.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I'm very lucky in that I get to speak to these very interesting, exciting teams, you know, companies all around the world, whether they're from oil and gas or finance or tech, and like the leadership teams like confide all their problems to myself and my partner, Dr. Greg, who is a clinical psychologist, and the two of us kind of give them recommendations on like, what are the interventions that they need to do in their culture? Maybe how to get people, some of the most common problems that companies hire us to work on is like, you know, how to make it safe for people to speak up in their culture. And that means like having a culture of psychological safety where people feel like it's okay for me to voice out. It's okay for me to challenge and, you know, speak up. Because if you have a culture where people are not safe to speak up and admit mistakes or point out things that are going wrong, it's kind of like that Boeing documentary, you know, where a lot of people, you know, they knew there were problems, but they didn't speak up because there was a culture of covering things up. So we know empirically when people don't feel safe to speak up, bad things happen. And, you know, in many cases, like it can lead to fatalities, accidents, and really bad consequences. So a lot of companies have now cottoned on to this concept called psychological safety. And they've realized that we need to invest in this because somehow if people don't feel safe to admit a mistake, to say something's going wrong, I want to show you something's not quite right, then actually bad things happen in companies. So that's one of the biggest. The second thing is probably like, you know, having difficult conversations. I think a lot of people need to learn difficult conversation skills, how to talk to somebody who's agitated or angry, how to deal with a difficult situation, like giving feedback to a boss that seems to be playing favorites or doing something unfair. Generally, especially in Asia, people are not so keen on giving feedback because it's a kind of a more harmonious, non-confrontational culture. So we have a lot of demand for like courageous conversations and difficult feedback skills. And then like a lot of boundaries work as well, because people don't know how to set boundaries and say no. So those are some of the popular things that like kind of like we get called in to do with individuals, leaders and companies.
Amazing. And I do want to ask you like the practical tips on all of those. But before we get into that, I want to acknowledge how amazing your story is. First of all, it's so fun to listen to you tell your story. But second of all, I love how what you do now really blends your background of both the corporate high level work, as well as the therapy, the soft empathy, like that side, because you lived both lives and then you put them together to serve in such a high way. So I'm just very amazed at your story and what you've been able to do.
Oh, thank you. I kind of feel I've done it in backwards, you know. I feel like I've done my retirement at 29 and I had like 7 years of being a retiree and like, you know, on a farm. And then I'm like, I had my second wave in my mid-30s. I didn't do anything the right way because I had my kids way young in my 20s, right? Yep. So everybody around me, my peers, they were going off and they were like conquering the world. They were like, you know, making strides in their career. And I was having two kids. And then after that, when I was doing my retirement, people were like, are you crazy? Like, this is like, these are the best years of your life.
Right. But look at you now, right? Like you did that. And then now you came back even better.
The thing is that like with women, we have seasons. And I think like, it doesn't matter so much the order in which you do your seasons. There's major advantages to having kids real young. And there's advantages to having kids later in life and all of that. But I think the most important thing is like to know that you have seasons is an important thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. To understand that like, I need to, in this season of my life, make priorities. And like, I always like to say, you have a stove, right? And then you have like three or four burners. Like some people have more burners. Like, I don't know, like maybe Rachel has five burners, our good friend Rachel, right? You know, people only have three burners, right? But right. Like, whatever, you have a limited number of burners. You have like four flames on top of your oven. And like, you've got like 20 pots, right? And like, if we try to like put all the pots on, everything's going to turn out half-baked.
Oh, that's such a great metaphor. Yeah, it's so true.
So for me, it's like, as long as you understand the seasons, like, okay, in my 20s, this is whatever, for these 3 to 5 years, I'm in the season of my career. That's going to be number one. I'm going to go and I'm going to freaking ace it, la, la, la. And then the next season is like, oh, now I've got young kids and they're the number one big flame, you know?
Yep. You got to prioritize them.
And all of that, you know? But like, it's important as a woman to realize that society has so many expectations of us. Society has literally given us like 20 or 30 pots, you know, and to flame up. And we've only got like 3 or 4 flames. So like, we need to be very, very good at organizing ourselves, prioritizing and being clear what season of life we're in. Otherwise, you know, everything will be half-baked and then we'll be disappointed.
Exactly. And it's so easy to compare yourself when you see other women. They might have other pots that they're firing, you know, if you look at everyone, of course, everyone looks like they have something amazing going on, but it's not everything, right? Each person just has a few.
For sure.
Let's pause for a moment to thank our sponsor, Shopify. Running the Lavender Shop has never been easier. Before using Shopify, I struggled with managing everything on my own, but now I have the tools I need right at my fingertips, from easy customization and inventory management to powerful analytics. Shopify makes it easy to bring your ideas to life and create a seamless shopping experience, whether you're just starting or scaling up. Their user-friendly system ensures you can focus on your passion, whether that's creating amazing products or connecting with your community without getting bogged down by technical challenges. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout we use with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/TLL, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TLL to upgrade your selling today. That's shopify.com/TLL. All right, Crystal. So I want to talk about your book, Deep Human, because that's where you explore like social, emotional skills. So tell us what deep human means and what are these skills that are so important in today's world?
The idea for Deep Human came about when we were in San Francisco doing public speaking. And, you know, we do a lot of public speaking. And one of the things that always bugged us was that people would always come up to us after our presentations and say, where's the book? And we'd be like, there's nothing, I don't have anything to sell you. And the Americans are so good, you know, Americans are so good with the PR and the marketing and the, you know, monetization of things. And like, we would always look at our other, you know, fellow academics or like in our field who are doing all this, you know, like especially the Stanford, you know, professors, they're so good. Look at your Andrew Huberman's and so forth, right? All the academics, they're like Carol Dweck, they're really good at marketing themselves. And then Greg and I will always look at, you know, each other. We're like, we're so busy doing things. We should write something. We should like talk about what we're doing. So finally, you know, we were at San Francisco at this conference called Wisdom 2.0. It's like,
I've been to that.
Oh, have you been?
I went this past year. Oh yeah, it's God. Amazing.
Yeah. So we were there in 2018. We were speaking on the main stage and it was like an intimidating experience because we were just, I think after Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's like the godfather of mindfulness. And I think we were before another really famous person like Goldie Hawn or somebody like that. Anyway, so it's like, you know, if you're about mindfulness and personal growth, they're like the superstars are all in the front row. You've got Byron Katie, Jack Kornfield, you've got Sharon Salzberg, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's looking at us and we're like, shit, you know, oops, can I swear?
Yeah, it's okay.
we're like, oh my God. And the front row is full of the people like who are our literal heroes, right?
Yeah.
So that was one moment where we realized that we have something to say. We have a message because after we gave our presentation, which was about, you know, a brave new world, it was like the future of education, the future of wisdom in the modern world, these skills that I'm talking about that became the book. Afterwards, we were like in the, you know, like the speakers area, like the green room and all of that. And all these famous people who we revered, like Jon Kabat-Zinn or whatever, they were coming up to us and asking us about our work. And we were like, are you serious? Do you guys actually want to know about our work? And a really good friend of ours now, who wasn't a good friend, but you know, it's very, very, we met back then, is a person called Rick Hansen. Do you know Rick Hansen?
Mm-mm, I haven't heard.
He's like, I don't know how many times New York Times bestselling author. He wrote Buddha's Brain, Hardwiring Happiness, Resilience. These are all very iconic books in neuroscience of mindfulness way back when the mindfulness wave just started. So Rick Hansen then got to know us and he gave us a lot of advice as well about how to write books and all of that. So our book, Deep Human, essentially the concept is that in a world of deep tech, what separates you from the robots is deep human. So very clean concept. It's like these are the five meta skills or super skills that no matter how fast the world changes, you will always need these skills. They are timeless. Yeah. They will never go out of style. And you need them as long as the world has humans. So yeah. We did a lot of research and we identified these five skills, which are number one, focus. Or at focus and mindfulness. Number two is self-awareness. Number three is empathy. Number four, it's complex communication, like difficult conversations. And number five is adaptive resilience. So how do you kind of adapt, be flexible, and then bounce back from adversity? So like, you know, these are the five. And like normally, you know, we kind of double click on the each of the five, you know, and speak a little bit more about it if you like.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us, what do you think, like consider our listeners, like what out of the five, what are there any that particularly people need to start working on and then help us give some actionables on how to grow in those areas?
All right. So I know your audience is really into mindfulness.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is the first skill, focus and mindfulness. We always say that you are living in a world with weapons of mass distraction and, you know, your TikTok and your Instagram and all of that. It's cutting our attention into little slivers. And it's very important to realize that we can grow our attention. And unlike the other skills, a lot of skills, we learn them to get good at something so that we are successful in life. Yeah. So it's kind of like, I learned this, I'm good at it, and then I became successful. But mindfulness is unlike any other skill because mindfulness simply is life. Mindfulness is active noticing. simply put, two words, active noticing. So when we actively notice, we are living. And I'm sure like many of us, you realize that your world's speeding up, right? Like you just blink your eyes and suddenly it's August. Oh my God. You know, as the older we get, the faster time goes. Do you feel that way sometimes?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. All the time.
Yeah. It gets really scary, I tell you, when you're in your 40s and it's like, wow, what the hell?
Like a year just goes by so fast.
Yeah, absolutely. But like what you pay attention to and how much you actively notice literally shapes the quality of your existence. You can go to, for example, you can go for a massage and you can be distracted by your thoughts and your to-do list. And then before you know it, 90 minutes is up and you're like, oh, I didn't even feel that massage, right? I didn't even experience it. Or you can really be mindful and be present and like pay attention to your therapist's, like, you know, hands on your body and really be in the moment and breathe. And then you get the full 90 minutes. But I think like mindfulness is simply the most fundamental, you know, skill that we can ever have. It's the ability to hone our active noticing and observation, which those skills are actually very sadly degenerating, especially for the younger generations. They don't notice as much as we did before because of all this like smartphones and technology and everything. It means that when you're always looking at a screen, you're not really paying so much attention to everything else around you. So yeah, so I would definitely say mindfulness is the one thing to start with. But then the next thing that I'm really keen on is self-awareness. So Tasha Urich is the world's leading researcher on self-awareness. And she found that 90%, like 85 to 90% of people believe they're highly self-aware. Guess what is the real percentage of people who are highly self-aware, according to her research?
50. 40. And how does she measure self-awareness?
Yeah, she's a researcher. She has all kinds of skills. So there's internal self-awareness and external. So internal is how clear are you about your own strengths, weaknesses, values, goals, etc. How clearly do you know what you want out of life and what you're about? And then there's external self-awareness, which is how clear are you on how aware are you of how you come across? So for example, if I think in a meeting that I'm the funniest person in the room and like I keep on making these cringy jokes and no one's laughing, but I think I'm really good, right? That's low external self-awareness. Yeah. And they don't go hand in hand. So sometimes people can be high on internal. I know what I want and I have no clue how I come across. Those people are what we call introspectors. So they know what they want, but they're, you know, they oftentimes don't have really good human connections or relationships because they rub people the wrong way because they are kind of oblivious to how they interact. And then sometimes it's the opposite. Like if you have high external self-awareness and you're always looking at how others are receiving you and always shaping yourself to suit other people, but you have low internal self-awareness, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I want. I just like, you tell me, jump and I'll say how high, right? Those are what we call the people pleasers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So therefore, like Tasha Urich's research is also measuring like how aware are you about yourself, your goals, your strengths and whatever. And also how aware are you of how you come across in different situations?
Oh, totally. Yes.
So basically her research found out that 90% of people think they believe they're highly self-aware, but the real number is actually much lower than what you guess. It's actually 10 to 15%.
Oh, wow.
So what she wrote famously was like, she said, on any given day, 80% of people are lying to themselves about themselves.
Yeah. Yo, that makes so much sense.
And it makes so much sense because like, we know it, right? When you have friends, you can kind of see friends who are like, oh my God, I met the best guy. He's really different from all my exes. And it's, you know, it's just, my God, it's the same relationship. You're doing the same mistakes.
Exactly. But they don't see it yet. They're not aware.
They're not aware. It's so hard for people to be self-aware. We can all spot it in other people, but it's so hard to spot it in ourselves.
And is that something that you teach people how to develop? Because that is tough. How do you develop better external self-awareness and internal self-awareness?
Yeah, this is interesting because remember I talked about mindfulness. So mindfulness is the process of active noticing and collecting data. right? So in other words, imagine that I'm in a meeting with you. At that point of time, when I'm in the meeting, I can kind of almost like pause the frame. At that point, at any point of time, I can collect data from three different data feeds. I can collect data from myself, which is my thoughts, my emotions, what's happening in my body. Is my heart beating faster as I talk to Aileen? Like, you know, what are my beliefs? What kind of mindsets do I have? Like, do I have a fixed mindset? Like I'm saying to myself, oh gosh, I'm such an idiot. Why did I, you know, mispronounce that word? Or why did I stuff up? And I could be like having all these negative thoughts or whatever. So I can pay attention to actively notice my thoughts, emotions, bodily sensations. The second data feed is the other person. So I can notice you. You know, I can notice, like, are you leaning forward? Are you engaged? Are you curious? Right. Are you frustrated? Are you bored? I can notice your body language, micro expressions, your words, mm-hmm. etc., your energy. Mm. And then the third data feed is the environment or the wider world. So for example, I may, as I'm talking to you, realize that, oh, wow, we've only got 30 minutes left. Or like, you know, whatever it is, the light shining in your eyes, or like you look thirsty or whatever. I could notice something about the environment, like, oh, you know, the dog's barking outside.
Oh, blah, blah. Yes, I see.
So really coming back to self-awareness, the process of mindfulness allows you to clean off your sensors. So you collect more data so that when you are in the present moment and your mind is focused in the present, it's not thinking about dinner. It's not thinking about what happened earlier on, the quarrel you had with your boyfriend this morning. You are collecting the most data you can in the present moment. And now with all of that data, it allows you to be more self-aware.
It makes so much sense. Wow. Thanks for breaking it down like that. The three data feeds. And it is true. Awareness is just about noticing, right?
Yes. And also a lot of us need to understand what are our autopilots or our defaults. For example, some people are very other focused. So imagine this situation, like you're walking into a cocktail party, like a networking event, right? Some people, their default is like, notice others, like, you know, oh, you know, when I'm talking to you, I'm trying to see, do you like me? Do you like me? You know, what am I saying? Like, what's it about you? How can I make you feel a certain way? Some people are very self-absorbed. They're very self-focused. They're like, oh, I feel like this. Everyone's watching me. Oh, you know, I want to get this, or I want to achieve this out of this conversation. They're very transactional. I know where I'm going with this. Oh, I want to monetize this conversation, whatever. Yeah, you know, no good or bad, right or wrong. But like everyone has got a default. Or some people are just very environmental focused. They're like, wow, you know, I'm noticing the vibe of this party. I'm noticing all these people in the room. I'm noticing, oh, the DJ spinning these cool tunes. I'm noticing all this stuff. Yeah. So each of us kind of has like default that we kind of like over focus on. So like I normally say to people, like in the pursuit of self-awareness, you need to understand what are your autopilot behaviors. If you step into a cocktail party and your first default behavior is, oh, you know, let me focus on myself. And like, I feel so awkward and I'm thinking over analyzing everything I do and la, 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 then maybe you need to hone your other two data feeds.
Yeah. Like start noticing other people and the details in others.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I love that. That's so helpful. All right. Time for a quick break. The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. The holiday season can be a mix of joy, warmth, and let's be honest, a bit of overwhelm. It's a time when caring for your mental well-being can be easily overlooked, but it's one of the greatest gifts you can give to yourself. BetterHelp is here to help you find that balance. It connects you with a licensed therapist who understands your needs and works around your schedule, all from home. Whether you're dealing with holiday chaos, setting personal boundaries, or just seeking a bit of extra support, BetterHelp makes it easy to prioritize your well-being. Getting started is simple. Answer a few questions, pick a therapist you like, and take that first step towards caring for yourself. Find comfort this December with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/TLL today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TLL. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know it's a common difficulty is like having difficult conversations, right? Whether it's in the workplace or whether it's in your relationships with friends, what are your tips on being better, having those courageous conversations?
researchers Maxfield and Granny did a fantastic research study on 11,000 people, and they found out that before you get into a difficult conversation, one brilliant tactic is to what they call intent before content. So that means to share your intention for the conversation before getting into the content of it, right? So imagine if we're about to have a difficult conversation, and I actually want to say to you, Eileen, I totally disagree with your stance on this. You know, the data you're looking at is you're presenting is incorrect, right? If I were to just go straight into that, you would probably feel like really defensive,
right?
And then right. we would have this conversation, and you know that is over before it even started. So what they found, these researchers, is that there were two findings that they had. What they did was that they showed people, two actors, a male and a female actor, and they were both reading the same lines from the same script. And the lines were, I totally disagree with the data that you presented. It goes against blah, 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 right? Interestingly, they asked the observers to then rate the actor in terms of likability, competence, and how much market value or their salary do you think they should earn. Mm-hmm. Now, before the woman and the men started objecting and being difficult, everyone rated the woman as more likable than the men. But the moment the actors started saying the difficult things, right? Like, I totally disagree with the data. The people, the observers actually penalized the woman much more than the men. So she was, I don't have the exact data, but she was penalized like tens of thousands of dollars in terms of her salary. They felt she should earn less. They felt that she was less effective and less competent at work when she was disagreeing, even though the man said the same things. And their research pointed out that there's this kind of like societal expectation that women should be pleasing. They should go along. And when they disagree, they are more likely to be labeled as hysterical, bitchy, you know, dragon lady, all these kind of stereotypes, because like people don't know what to do with a disagreeable woman. In stereotypes, they, you know, you're supposed to be smiling and pleasing, right? So that was the first piece of their research. And the second piece of their research was like, however, when both the male and the female use these, what they call framing sentences or intent before content, they actually managed to reduce the negativity of how they were perceived at significantly. So let me demonstrate to you. The technique sounds a bit like this. Before you pound the table or disagree, you say something like, hey, Eileen, I really care deeply about honesty or integrity or whatever it is. You know, I care deeply about this project. I care deeply about the success of this initiative. And that's why I'm going to be quite direct about this, or that's why I'm going to speak quite passionately about this. And then I go into the conversation.
Yeah, it does change it. It's you're shaping the conversation in a way where the other person can empathize. Like, oh, I see. I understand.
Yeah. And what they found out is that when you have these so-called framing sentences, sharing your intention first makes the other party feel that you are thoughtful, that it is considered, and that you haven't suddenly lost the plot and you're not being overly emotional or like whatever it is. Okay. So especially in Asia, where it's a very harmonious culture, I actually added on to this theory. I think it's very important to do in-grouping as well, a technique called in-grouping. So in-grouping is using a lot of we language, we, our, and you know, collective language. So for instance, I had a real life example just day before yesterday. I was coaching somebody and she was working with a very difficult peer. So they were both team leads and this peer of hers was being very defensive. And I advised her to say something like this. This person, by the way, a difficult person, was a newcomer to the organization she was in. So I advised her to say something like, hey, let's call him Frank, for example. Yeah. So I told her, instead of like what she did, which was just to send an email and to say, Frank, your team's not delivering, there's no accountability, blah, 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 which is what she did and ended up disastrously. But I was coaching her to instead have the conversation offline. Don't put it in an email. Like, call the person up, do it face to face. It's more intimate, it's more respectful. And to say something like, hey, Frank, before I get into this conversation, I wanted to say that when I saw that you had joined our organization, I was really excited because I felt like, you know, there's so much to learn from you. You've had 10 years in this other organization, and I'm excited at the great things that we can achieve together. I really feel that our teams need to work closely together for the success of this initiative. And I'm looking forward to us having a long and fruitful or constructive relationship. And because of that, I want to be quite direct and transparent because I think there are some areas of tension that we need to address. But I want you to know that, like, I feel like you're somebody who can really appreciate that transparency. And similarly, for you, if you ever see anything that you want to give me feedback on, I would really appreciate it if you, you know, return the favor as well. So all of this is before we've even gone into the difficult conversation.
Exactly. Wow.
You're kind of setting the tone because I always remind people, when it's a difficult conversation, you got to remember there's something in your brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is alarm bell, and it's always kind of like ringing. Its job is to scan the horizon for danger. If it finds any danger or any threat, then it starts ringing and it starts activating a very reactive fight or flight or, you know, state where people get quite aggressive or defensive or they shut down. So in a difficult conversation, the first and I would say only priority at the start is to deactivate the other party's alarm bell.
Yes. Make them feel safe. Make it feel like you're on the same team.
That's right.
And you're working together. Yeah.
Exactly. Because imagine there's a car.
It's not an attack, because if you attack, they just defend, right?
Well, sure. You know, the thing is, like, it's like the amygdala is so strong. It's such a survival mechanism. It's like a car alarm. Imagine that there's a car alarm outside your house going off and it's rah, rah, rah. And then, like, you're trying to have like a logical conversation with somebody. You can't hear them because the alarm is so loud. So it's the same thing. When we're going to a difficult conversation, the first order of a priority is to deactivate the car alarm. And how do we deactivate it? We need to signal, I am not a threat to you. We're on the same team. We, a lot of this we energy, you know, we are working on this together. And, you know, even something as simple as saying, hey, Aileen, I'm so glad we've both made time for this. It's such a simple sentence. Like, you could say it to your worst enemy, but like, it's literally like, I'm glad that both of us are coming together on this. But you'll be surprised at how powerful this like simple sentence is, because it's a we sentence.
Yeah.
And like, the moment we kind of frame the conversation in the we or our terms, right, it actually changes the mentality from it's me against you, and it's more like a us kind of thing. It's a collaborative problem solving conversation. It's not like a power struggle between me or you, right or wrong, win or lose.
Yeah. Wow. So powerful, so effective. Thank you for sharing. I know we're kind of running out on our time, Crystal. You have so many great insights. I guess one last question is, I want to learn about you, your lifestyle, habits, or routines, because you've learned so much in your years. So how do you go about your days or your weeks and live your life to ensure that you're always, like, I guess, optimized in whatever that means to you?
Last year, I started a business with our mutual friend, Rachel, called I Am Well. And it's a productivity and self-care journal, because we are both geeks about productivity and self-care. And what we found out is that especially for us working women, you know, we felt like there's a lot of productivity stuff out there, which is very alpha male. It's like, slay your goals, crush your goals, wake up at 5 o'clock, you know, do the cold bath, that kind of stuff, which is very kind of hard and productivity focused. And then there's a lot of stuff that's out there that's very self-care-ish. It's kind of like manifest, you know, set intention.
A little too like feminine, right? You're trying to find a balance between those two.
We actually felt we were both.
Yes, love it.
We felt like we wanted to slay our goals and we wanted to take care of ourselves and our inner child and our emotional side and all of that. And we just couldn't find a way of doing that, which is why we came up with this journal, which is kind of like one half of it is reflecting. So every day you have like different reflection prompts that cycle through mind, emotions, body, spirit. You know, where you might ask, you know, the prompt for the day might be something like the last time I cried was dot, dot, dot. And, you know, the last time I felt a surprising emotion was dot, dot, dot. And it was dot, dot, dot. So there's that element of daily morning reflection on something that's like, you know, that's something quite profound. And also the same journal is very much about goal setting. So one of the practical takeaways that that for your audience is this thing that we call the life domains exercise. So there is like 9 domains, and you can do this yourself. You can pick out domains that matter to you. For example, work, relationships, you know, mental health, emotional health, spirituality, et cetera. But we've identified like 9 different domains of life. And like the process is like every so often in our journal, it's every quarter, we encourage people to do a rating on a scale of 1 to 10. The first column is like, how important in this season of life is each domain to you? Yeah. Mm. And it's interesting because a lot of women will put like everything's a 10 or everything's a 9. They can't all be 9 or 10s. That's really unrealistic, right? So sometimes my kids are going to be 10. Sometimes they're going to be 7. Sometimes they're going to be 8. You know, sometimes my career is going to be, I don't know, whatever. But so the first kind of exercise is to not rank, but to rate these domains. How important right here, right now is each domain? And then the second column is how much time and effort am I investing in each of these domains on a scale of 1 to 10. So what we want to do now is look for gaps. So for example, if you tell me family is 10 out of 10 importance, yeah, but then time and effort you've actually invested is like 3 out of 10. That's what we call a gap. So what I encourage people to do in the pursuit of self-awareness is to really get clear about like where the gaps in their life are, because we are never ever perfect in our allocation of time to our priorities, you know, but we need to constantly recalibrate and align ourselves with, you know, to work on our gaps.
Yeah, love that. So actionable. I have something similar in my workbook that I created, but it's like I call it the self-reflection wheel.
Oh, I love that.
But it also has different areas of life where you rate how you're doing from 1 to 10.
Yay.
But what I love that you added was like, rate which ones are most important to you right now. Because I know we all, we try to be perfect, perfectly balanced in all areas, but it's impossible. So you're going to have to prioritize some.
Yeah. Sometimes for some people, like certain domains are 0. Like, you know, I have friends in this season is like, oh, you know, I've just come out of a divorce and actually love and intimate relationships is 0 importance. I'm not interested in that. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, more power to you. All of it doesn't need to be equal. And in fact, like the thing about what we suggest is like, you're going to have 3 or 4 burners, right? Just like what we said, you need to pick those. And those are the ones that you're really going to kind of overemphasize or work on.
Love it. All right, Crystal, one final question. So if you could leave our listeners with just one piece of advice or wisdom.
You know, I love to say, take your work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. Because I find that, you know, in life, a lot of people do the reverse. They don't take their work seriously. They're not professional. They kind of like, you know, just wing it. But then they take themselves so seriously. Their ego is so sensitive. They get, you know, their noses put out of joint, you know, every little thing and all that. And I really find that, you know, the most successful people I know are the ones that really are very serious about their calling, their work. They feel like, wow, this is meaningful. This is sacred. The things that I do, the contributions that I make. But at the same time, they have this great lightness to themselves. They're able to take the piss out of themselves, as we say in England, you know, they take the Mickey out of themselves. They're self-deprecating. They can laugh at stuff. And the sense of humor is so powerful. Another deep human skill I didn't write about. I should have written about that book. But I really do think that in these like unstable, you know, uncertain times, like we need to have that levity, that sense of lightness, that sense of humor, while taking important things seriously. So it's that mixture of heavy and light.
Oh, I love that. I also try to live my life with a light heart, like to be more lighthearted. I think when you're young, everything's so serious and you just worry about everything and you take yourself so seriously. But I notice as I get older, I just am more free. Like you just feel lighter.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, Crystal, where can we find you online?
I'm on Instagram, TikTok, and LinkedIn, all at Crystal Lim Lange. I guess you'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes. Your name will be in the title. So
yeah, awesome. And I have weekly AMAs. So every single weekend, we have like hundreds of AMA questions that get sent to me on everything to do with work, with my horrible boss, with my weird colleagues, all that. And I'm kind of like Singapore's work bestie, where I answer everyone's like work and life related issues. And we are going for season 2 of my podcast, Comfort and Growth with Crystal Lim Lange soon. So yeah, that's something that I really hope one day will be as successful as yours. Come over and check it out. We have a lot of really great guests who are passionate about productivity and personal growth.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Of course, we'll link everything down below. Thank you so much today, Crystal. You just are such a light in this world. And I just love everything you do, everything you are. I really appreciate us making the time for this.
Thank you for making this time for our deep human chat.
Yes.
Thanks so much for listening to the Lavender Lifestyle. If you like the podcast, please show your support by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our podcast YouTube channel at youtube.com/lavender lifestyle. Lastly, follow me on YouTube and Instagram at Lavender for more content on creating your dream life. Sending you so much love. Bye.